Henrik here, Red Ice Radio. Welcome back. RedIceCreations.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, and YouTube. Also, subscribe to the full show at RedIceMembers.com. You can also hear the free show on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn, or subscribe in iTunes by adding our podcast feed manually. You can find me on Twitter at Henrik_Palmgren. H-E-N-R-I-K, palm as the palm tree, G-R-E-N, Palmgren. That's how it's pronounced in Swedish. And Facebook at The Real Henrik Palmgren, if you feel the need to, vent your anger and give me shit for our shows. Thank you very much. Well, today, folks, we are having a talk with Andrew Arnheimer, or Weave, as he's also known as, about black hat hacking, the future of Europe, Gamergate, the political situation in Syria, Assad, what and who is driving the war in the Middle East, and many more worrying, disturbing topics. He's gone from hacking to being more outspoken about being pro-white and being more on the alt-right side of things. Wikipedia also describes him as a white supremacist and an internet troll. So this should be good. We'll ask him more about that later. Well, this show was recorded a little bit over a week ago, and all I can say is that if you are easily offended, turn off now. Well, I don't know why anybody easily offended, crippled by political correctness, would be listening to this program. But, Andrew is a straight shooter. He tells it like he sees it and not afraid to say it. And, we don't want to censor someone either. So this is a show that truly gets to exercise that free speech muscle. Well, that's about the disclaimer that I'll give you for this one. But, I hope you will get a laugh in there as well. All right, let's cut over to Weave. Hey, Andrew, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us today. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, thank you. It's great to have you here. I wanted to, obviously ask you a bit more later here about your involvement in, becoming a defender of Western civilization and concerned with the survival of our people in a time now when it's obvious, more and more obvious to the most left-wing nutcase that we are uniquely being targeted with the extinction of our people like no other people on this planet at this stage. But before we go there, before we get into some of those topics and whatnot, do you want to tell us a little bit about your, past as a, I don't know, this is what Wikipedia said, whatever, but, your black hat activities. Who is Andrew? Where did you come from politically initially, Andrew?
I've always sort of, I've been a fan of European culture for a long time, and I had from a very long time, I felt like there's a decay in our civilization, right? And I felt like when I was a kid, it felt like it was uncool, right? It was bad. It was considered nerdy to be into like opera and classical music, and the entire body of what it is to be white seemed to be diminished, in the general consensus, the consciousness of America. Like the mindshare seemed to be dedicated to things that were foreign, like the what was on the television seemed not for me, It seemed for other people.
Yep.
So I mean, when I was a kid, I got this feeling, that civilization, there was something wrong. I couldn't put my finger on it, what exactly had happened to my civilization, and my parents were just like utter shitlibs, like just totally brainwashed by the agenda. But I had the benefit of being, because I became a computer programmer, and my first job, I programmed PLC devices for factory lines, and then I started a small ISP and I sold it, and so I sort of had autonomy,
right
from from my family, and I was able to travel a significant amount and just sort of be able to form opinions on where the West was going, and what we need to do to avert its current path. And I started, being involved in the computer underground, because there's it's a very, like, programming is a white thing, right? Like,
oh yeah,
like all the major programming languages that are out there are made by white people.
Well, that's like, why it's like, racist, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why there's this huge effort of the tech feminists, you know, and the diversity in tech crowd.
Exactly.
There's Ruby, I guess, which was made by a Japanese dude, but beyond that, it's like the entire contribution of computer sciences has generally been a white European contribution, you know, and it remains so to this day. And there's definitely an undercurrent, you know, of dissatisfied white men and technology. You know, there's like, we've all been given a raw deal, and we're smart enough to try to do something about it. And that's like, technology became sort of my implement of protest.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of the you know, hacktivist seems to be very, very left leaning. I mean, we have the Pirate Party and all that stuff in Sweden. Were you ever into kind of that angle of any of the social justice warrior from the hacking point of view?
No, it seems stupid. I mean, I never got it. You know, I think that the Pirate Party is sort of toothless, you know, but it's given a lot of airtime in the media because they don't want to focus on, like, what the common undercurrent of technology, like, of practitioners of it are, which is definitely way more right-leaning than the Pirate Party. The Pirate Party doesn't seem to represent, I mean, we all hate, like, Hollywood, right? Because it's like a Jew machine, you know, but I don't think that confronting it in the way that the Pirate Party is confronting it has they done anything. It's just, you know, it's been completely ineffective.
Do you think that that's been a plan? Because obviously some people that they're pointing to, Carl Lundström, you know, as one of the financiers of the Pirate Bay in the initial days, and allegedly, you know, he's like a Nazi or something, right? So that some people speculated that they did this and they started to, you know, distribute, or not distribute, but, you know, with the torrent aspect of this, to try to financially kind of chip away at Hollywood. Do you think there's any truth to that?
I think that's absolutely, like, there's a common undercurrent of, like, it's okay to rob Jews, right? Like, you know, let's do what we can to fuck up their lines of finance. But I think that might be in the mind of Carl Lundström, but I don't think it's in the mind of people who participate in the Pirate Party. Most of the people in that crowd are just, you know, like now it's like a bunch of them are abandoning it because they're like, the Pirate Party isn't enough good, a good enough vehicle to, like, solve the refugee problems. You know, we need to help the brown people. You know, but it's the political machinery that piracy has spawned has not been particularly useful or impressive to me.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of nuances to that about what's happening. Maybe a little bit later we can talk more about if, you know, hacking in any regard is could be some kind of aid and solution to some of the problems that we're facing. But do you want to tell us a little bit about the case that ended you in prison eventually? You know, there's the AT&T thing. There's a number of things. What would you like our audience to know about that?
Yeah, it was June of 2010. And there was a public AT&T web server, you know, and there was a URL on this web server, like, you'd enter into the, and, you know, like, you type it in the address bar of your web browser, like google.com, right, you know. And at the end of this URL, this AT&T website URL, there's a number. And if you just add one to this number, you see the next iPad 3G user, like, customer record. And it was bad. It wasn't, like, particularly sensitive data, but it was bad because if you have another exploit for the iPad, you could use it to, like, target iPad users. If you have everybody's email address, you could send an exploit to all of them, blah, blah, blah. Basically, like, you know, AT&T fucked up and Apple fucked up. And I took this data. I added one to this number at this end of this URL a bunch. And I took this data and I gave it to a journalist because I feel if a big company puts you at risk, you deserve to know about it so you can mitigate the risk that you've been exposed to. But at this point, I was already a target of federal prosecutors. They decided that they were going to make a case out of this. I didn't break into anything. It was a public web server. You know, I didn't bypass any security mechanisms. AT&T, by their words at trial, they use the word published, you know, to say, like, it's on the record. Like, they published this data. And the government accuses me of committing a crime for daring to access things that are published. You know, it's pretty much the equivalent of if you walk into a bookstore and you open a book, you know, and they've accidentally, like, appended at the end of this book, like, a spreadsheet of their like, you know, employees' social security numbers or something, and then they charge you with a crime for noticing that it's at the end of the, like, in the notes of this book. Like, that's so...
Well, isn't that a huge problem, you know, Andrew, that they don't really, they never really understood the technology? It's kind of in the same way that they went after torrents, like, you have, you know, movies on your website, you know, we're going to go after you. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. You don't understand the technology. It seems like a similar kind of case, right?
I don't think these men are not particularly dumb. I don't think that they misunderstood anything. I think that it was pure malice, like, beginning to end. There was a Jewish prosecutor, you know, and he invited his whole synagogue to spectate, you know. So I've been a commentator on what I feel is our answers to the Jewish question for a long time, and I think, like, this guy chose to indict me because he doesn't like my politics, you know, and then I'm stuffed in a court and there's a bunch of fucking grinning Jews in the audience while these guys put me away for, like, I didn't commit a crime, you know. They kidnap me from my home at gunpoint. They bring me thousands of miles away. They bulldoze my home. And I don't think that misunderstanding had anything to do with it. That had nothing to do with it. Right. This was malice. This was targeting me for my lawful political speech.
Right. And they knew about your opinions and whatnot because, well, I was kind of reading through some of your, you know, bio, if you will, or try to follow through on what happened. And I got the perception a little bit that it was kind of like after prison that you kind of got a bit more vocal and outspoken. But if they knew about your opinions beforehand, that's a whole different case, a whole different ballgame right there then.
Yeah, I was always outspoken. I mean, you can read my live journal and go back to 2008, and I'm naming the Jew in 2008. It's not about, it's I guess it became more of an issue after I was out of prison because, like, I'd sort of been become a folk hero at this point, especially in like the hacker community, you know, and they felt really threatened by, you know, before I was just talking about Jews in my own little corner of the internet now, but, like, now people, a significant more quantity of people listen, and they really, and they're all educated people, you know. It's not like previous, it was sort of like, you know, my readers were like IRC people, and they weren't particularly well connected or wealthy. But now I have an audience that is significantly, they have advantages in life, you know, and they listen and they take what I say carefully. And I don't think the establishment likes that at all, you know, like, for sure.
No, that's true. That's true. So tell us a bit what how things were like in prison. I know you got into the Norse Eddas and a number of different you know, books and whatnot as well. I guess, again, if I go back jokingly to the Wikipedia thread, it's like, that's when you became a white supremacist, right?
I mean I've always been like a white nationalist, you know, and the way I look at, like, the term white supremacy is, like, isn't white supremacy diversity? Like, Africans are supreme in Africa, right? Like, it's not like the Chinese aren't supreme in China. Like, why shouldn't whites be supreme in the nations of their forefathers? That just seems to me to be equality and diversity to me, like everything that the left supposedly stands for, right?
But, well, you know, from that point of view, then it makes sense that they want to end white supremacy, meaning they want to end white rule in our own countries, right?
Exactly. But before prison, I was like Christian identity, you know, like I had a sense that I was trying to fit my worldview into the framework. I never was really, like, super enthused about Christianity, but I mean, I looked at that, like, how Adolf Hitler presented, like, the positive Christianity thing, right? And I thought that, like, maybe Christianity could be a useful vehicle into spreading white identity, you know? But it didn't, like, after I went to prison, right, and I see, like, there's, like, fucking pedophiles and, you know, all sorts of degenerates like lining up for their absolution on Sundays at the prison chapel. And like, I don't really want to be a part of a club that says anyone can be saved. Like, that's my opinion, you know, like I want to be part of the club that like has no, like no non-Europeans in it. And I don't want to be a part of a club that lets kid fuckers in, you know, like that's the doctrine of universal salvation of Christianity. It just like, it was exposed in prison. It's revolting, you know, and there's no, this is where cultural Marxism comes from to me. Like, of course, Christianity held the door open of Europe to fucking, you know, Jewish domination and a horde of refugees because they're all precious souls to save, right? You know, it just seems to be at the end of the day that you can't reconcile Christianity with saving white people on a long enough timeline. Like, there was certainly a time when Christendom had the interests of Europeans at heart, but it was in spite of the doctrine of Jesus. It was, you know, the Crusaders had the heart of the Vikings. You know, they were filled with that Norman love of war that the Normans brought from the Nordic territories. I don't think that you can reconcile Jesus with you know, protecting white people. I think on a long enough timeline, and just look at what like the church has done, right? What does it do better than anything these days? Breed brown people, lots of brown people.
Well, look at the first, you know, the first crusade, 1096 to 1099. I think there's a reason that that was a success and not all the following ones, considering that they truly had people both of the dual faith, but also full on, you know, pagans. And literally there were like lots of Norse people as well, participatory in this. And I think it's just gotten, you know, the deeper and deeper we've gotten into Christianity in Europe, the weaker and weaker it has made us, you know?
Absolutely.
Do you think that hackers today are, you know, can they, are they able to play a role in the fight, if you will, for, you know, our own interests and basically the preservation of our people, do you think?
I think that they have the only role. I mean, it's not that I don't want to spread the pro-white message, because it's useful for people to breed, you know, and keep within their race and represent the interests of their race and teach these things to their children. But the most important thing you can teach your children right now is computer programming, because battles in the future are going to be done entirely by autonomous machines, like 100%, right? And so the struggle for our race is going to be about like image processing algorithms. It's going to be about signal processing calculus. It's not so much going to be held like by men with explosives and guns. Like you can make a drone now that can kill people, and it can kill people way faster and more effectively. And as the price of these things comes down because of advancements in additive manufacturing technologies, we're eventually going to get to a cusp in this progression called APM, atomically precise manufacturing. And when we have atomically precise manufacturing, the kind of warfare that elicits total war, you know, that this will be available to organizations that are much smaller than state entities. You know, the good news for the white race, even though it looks bad right now, right? Like, we're being overrun in every single one of our countries, and on, like, right now it looks really bad. But there's a saving grace that very soon the progression of technology will take us to a point where only high IQ individuals will be able to participate in the peak of warfare, and the progression of technology favors small, you know, committed actors. You know, like right. You'll be able to print a drone that will be able to kill non-whites as long as you know how to program it, and like that's. This is going to be a change, you know, it's going to drastically change warfare as a whole, and it's going to reintroduce this kind of tribal warfare, you know, that we saw in the early days of our people. I think that hackers have the most important role to play, and that's just a fact of the technology, right? Like, every world war is brought on by a change in the technology of warfare that mandates a total war to determine who the victor is. Like World War I, like we had the beginning of air technology. World War II, like Hitler figured out that nobody was using a tank the right way, right? And it just spreads like through the whole world and the war as a result that one person figured out that like a technology was being used in a dumb way. And then World War II was ended by the advent of other technologies that changed the way of battle that couldn't have been anticipated by the enemy, like the advent of proper cryptanalysis, which was also made by a white European, Alan Turing. And the also the, of course, like you could, some people would clump the atom bomb into there, but that was I guess that was more of a just showing the Russians like what we're capable of there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that yeah, like the most important thing is that like more important than teaching your kids how to shoot is to teach your kids to program computers.
Interesting. You know, I've been thinking about the future of technology, both you know, where transhumanism is going and all these kinds of things, but also the worry about who not only is going to finance this thing and who's going to get into it, but who's going to program these robots. I mean, you know about the kind of the version that we get from Hollywood, right, in sci-fi, that the AI will be born, it will get loose accidentally and kind of turn on humanity. But the fact is, we could still have a scenario where certain people could literally program a new system that goes into place, a robotic army, be that an artificial intelligence or something else. And literally, that's what could be turned loose on Europeans, for all we know, right? I mean, it's all about who has the power to program these robots, right?
Absolutely.
And that's kind of scary. Is there? Have you thought about that in terms of what they're trying to, you know, kind of inject into us in terms of that? Oh, this will be an accident. This is all, you know, when Skynet is born, right? All of this will just accidentally turn loose. But is there any way that we can fight this? I mean, how do you see the future of this? It just seems like utter chaos to me when I think about it, of all these different you know, groups and entities are trying to rush to a technology in order to kind of keep them safe.
I mean, I'm bullish on it for the reason that the contributions to computer science that we know of, right, are white and European. We have a natural advantage in this battlefield if only we embrace it. And as a society, we really train children from the youngest age possible to maintain our racial supremacy in this particular field of expertise. And because like how much has been done by non-whites? We outside like as I said earlier, we got Ruby, which is from a Japanese guy, which is a clusterfuck, and we have PHP, which is from the Jews, which is largely considered just the worst abomination of programming in the world. You know, so like everything else, you know, every single notable bit of computer architecture is that we use today is made by white Europeans, and so we have the advantage. These things are made by people that are genetically like us, that they are made to fit our brains because they're made generally by English and German speakers, right? So when we operate in this niche, we operate and a reality that we spawned and that we currently control if we're not dumb enough to give it up.
So do you think it's about awakening, you know, the interest and the ideas in these people's minds and have them realize that there actually is a war on them? Because I think that this is where the disconnection lies right now. We have hostile elites within our own countries. Some are us, some are not us. They are outsiders, but nonetheless, they are basically quite openly, you know, they say what they want. They're advocating for white displacement and European displacement, and in some cases, replacement migration through immigration and all these kinds of things. But most people are just not aware of this yet. They're not in the fight, so to speak. So right now, we're obviously losing because we don't have the numbers of participants in this battle, right?
Well, absolutely, and that's why I think that that white issues are so important to talk about, and I spend a large part of my time doing so because you know, we're coming up to this moment in which there's going to be you know, the final battle, you know, to determine how the world is divided for a very long time, and we need to get as many people on our side before this battle occurs, or you know, or we could lose. But I think that the numbers are pretty positive, and that the more people, the more Europeans are surrounded by non-Europeans, like, the more radical they very quickly become. You know, because it's very easy, you know, when you see on the media, like, you know, they emotionally blackmail people with these pictures of the, you know, some drowning Syrian kid washed up on a shore. But, like, you can only do that for as long as people don't know what the Sunnis in Syria are actually like, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like, when they're your neighbors, it's a different story. Very, very quickly, in America, too, you know, we've had this, they've pushed this, you know, you got to have the integration for so long, you know, and for a long time, it was, everybody was like, oh, of course, you know, and then it ends up in their neighborhood, you know, and they're like, holy shit, this is a real problem, you know, and now we have Trump as a result, where immigration has become such an issue, you know, where it hasn't been in America for 80 years, like, nobody has cared. Finally, everybody's like, oh, wow, this is a real issue, you know, and I think it's the same, like you saw, like, Anders Breivik advocate for Israel, you know, but he's never met a Jew, right? Like, he doesn't, there weren't any Jews where he lived, you know, he doesn't know them as a people. So
he was kind of semi influenced by one, you know, Fjordman. It came out that, you know, one of the writers behind his, what had his change of heart. He's Jewish. He was born to a Norwegian Jewish jazz musician in Oslo, you know?
Yeah, there's still not a lot of Jews in Norway. Like,
not too many.
Norwegian people.
But they still advocate for a white displacement up there, though. Of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you bring up a good point, though, because this immigration question is turning into the number one issue in my country, in Sweden. The Sweden Democrats, although they're kind of cucking out on a lot of issues, at least they are addressing the immigration issue. And at least if we are to believe the latest polls, they are now the biggest party in Sweden, which means that basically probably all the other seven parties are probably going to form some kind of coalition just to form an opposition to the Sweden Democrats, just because of the fact that they are raising the immigration question. But I think that's indicative of how important this is, that basically most other questions have been put to the side, because this is something that it is affecting us more than any other question right now.
Yeah, it's the same all around the West at this point. I mean, immigration is the issue, right? There's no other question that's as important to the maintenance of our civilization. Like we can't ask another question right now.
Well, obviously, this invasion that we're seeing right now into Europe, that is not going to lead to any kind of integration. Obviously, it's going so fast that I think the distinguishing points of what makes us different as human beings is going to become so obvious to people, and that the cultural differences are, and religious too, are going to be so noticeable that most people are going to be kind of forced into this, you know, debate, if you will, and eventually take a side. And basically, that's going to be, are you for the continuation of your own people, or are you for the destruction of it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, how are things in America? Do you believe Trump is part of this fix, or is he just kind of like an initial little step in the right direction of bringing some awareness to this issue?
You know, I don't think that the executive in America has enough power. I don't think, you know, as even if Trump is legitimate, you know, and he wants to do everything to change everything, he's going to get into power, and he's going to still be beholden to Congress to a degree where I don't know if he can solve the problem or not. But the great thing that I see about Trump is the way that he's delegitimizing the whole system while he acts, right? He stands up on a debate and says, yeah, I bribe politicians all the time. I've bribed some of my opponents, you know, like just the contempt for which he's treating the system and that's why the establishment is just so fucking afraid of him. You know, I don't think he can actually change things except that people can see him, you know, and see how he just doesn't give a fuck, and he'll say whatever the hell he pleases, and he won't be beholden to anybody, and that that can change the consciousness of our nation by itself. That's why I like Trump. Not that I think he can actually fix immigration. Not that like he's still like, you know, his daughter's married to a Jewess, you know, it's like and he's part of like a whole New York crowd. Like I don't trust him in the entirety, but I do like the fact that he's making people less afraid to say what they feel. And that is the step in the right direction.
Do you think it's largely over for America when it comes to the demographics? I mean, whites are still a majority, of course, in America, but as we've seen, as it's turning out in many, you know, European countries as well, the birth rates is lower. There's a lot of an older crowd of these people, and when they begin to go, the demographics is radically and quickly going to change. Is there hope for America, do you think? And if so, what is that hope?
I don't necessarily think that there's hope for the American Constitution. I think that that the government is going to have to break apart, and there's going to be a focus on much smaller political like states. You know, like there's going to be city states. There's going to like the city of Irvine right now is practically in California is practically a country of its own. It's totally different. Like that's going to be that's going to be the Singapore of America and Irvine. And you're going to have everything break into much smaller spheres of influence. And there's hope for whites in the Pacific Northwest and in Montana, you know, and Arkansas. You're going to have areas where whites maintain cultural supremacy, and then you're just going to have, you know, third world countries in America. Like Newark, New Jersey is worse than most of Africa at this point. You know, like there's just no saving it.
Jeez. So a breakup, probably some kind of secession states breaking off, because ultimately it's such a huge country, and there's so many different people, and the more and more, you know, different cultures you bring in of people, different races, you're going to have basically so many different interests within the country that it's going to be impossible for one, you know, president or one system to appeal to them. I'm surprised it has lasted as long as it has, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Just unbelievable, you know. So let's talk a bit more about how you feel of being over in Europe, though. I mean, do you feel that that's your home? Is that where you want to fight? Is that where you see the preservation? I know there's a lot of Americans that kind of go back and forth on this quite a bit. They know that they're from Europe if they're awake to these kinds of questions. At the same time, understandably, they love and appreciate America. They've been there for, you know, perhaps many generations. They have built something there. They've built a life for themselves there. And at the same time, I've heard some of their sentiments that they are, despite all that, willing to potentially uproot and or at least go and fight in Europe if and when it comes to that. What's your feelings about that?
I can't commit to a European country because there's no country where I'm out of reach of America on a long enough time frame. You know, I feel like, I mean, I want to be here in the Slavic nations in Europe, but I don't know if there's going to be a place for me with America as an adversary. Over the long term, I might have to go to Russia.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Serbia is very close. I mean, I tried to do it in Serbia. I love Serbia. I don't want to stay there, but it's just, you know, they're very much too close to the American government. There's no reconciling that with my life goals right now.
Well, you know, I think it's a good analogy of what happened in Serbia of what might happen in the rest of Europe if and when, you know, we get the kind of conflicts that they had there, that due to, you know, religious differences, the Serbian people started lashing out and defending themselves. And as we saw, NATO, America, the rest of the world basically descended upon them much in the same way they descended upon Germany when they tried to rise up and fight off those who are trying to, you know, destroy the country, basically. And that's kind of a nightmare scenario for me, really, that Serbia is kind of a microcosm of something that might happen on a larger scale when Europe kind of finally awakens to some of this. Who knows what might happen? I mean, we might have China, America, of course, but also even, you know, other Asian countries being armed by the global elite and ultimately being turned against Europe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely something to be concerned about. I share your fear there.
Let me ask you a bit more about Serbia. I think it was now apparently Hungary has been, I mean, they've been getting the brunt end of this, some really interesting statements by, you know, Orban and some of these other politicians in Hungary. They're obviously sick and tired of what's happening. They have a much more stronger sense of nationalism. I think the Eastern European countries have that as well because they have won their freedom more recently from the communist dictatorship that they experienced. So they're a little bit more reluctant than Western Europe to kind of abide by the laws and the rules of the EU, etc. But, you know, Hungary had been basically building fences. They've been trying stuff to stop the invasion. And now some of the channels of these people, the flood of people is coming in through other ways. And I believe some of it has been funneled through Serbia as well. Have you, when you're out and about, do you see any of this? How are things in Serbia right now?
Oh, there were a shit ton of Syrians in Belgrade when I was there. They were all sort of huddled around the bus and train station in Belgrade and waiting to leave, you know, because they're not welcome to stay in Serbia generally. You know, there's definitely no love for these people. But the attitude was like, well, we'll let them through, right?
Right.
Like, as long as they aren't going to stay here, then they can go on forward. But now it's like the border to Croatia is closed. You know, the border to Hungary is closed. And Bosnia is much poorer, you know, and now they're sort of left holding the hot potato, right? It's like where do these Syrians go now that all the borders are closed? And it's definitely sort of what's funny is all these countries are sort of fighting amongst themselves, you know, like they're taking their anger at this flood of Syrians. Like Croatia just got, there were like 40 Croatian cops just arrested in Hungary because they were smuggling all the Syrians over the border. You know, like,
God, yeah.
The Croats and the Hungarians are fighting instead of fighting the Syrians together. It's just really fucking, it's a tragedy, but it is funny.
Well, they just started to push them around and basically say, not our problem. But, I mean, let's face it, Germany, Sweden, they're as participatory in this, and well, they're the most participatory because everyone wants to go to these countries, and they have opened up their arms and said, come on in, we want you. 800,000, no problem, we'll let you in. We don't have anywhere to stay for you, but, you know, we'll give you everything you need, right? So they are ultimately the countries that are causing this initial kind of problem for Hungary, for Serbia, for Croatia, etc. But at least, not that that's good enough, but at least they're just, for those countries, passing through. I mean, Merkel in Germany have basically said, well, you know, we'll let them all in, and this is, you know, for all eternity, for all future, this is going to change the face of Germany, you know?
Yeah, I think that something needs to be done in Germany, for sure. Like, Merkel needs to be taught a fucking lesson. Something has to happen there real fast, you know? And I saw that there are definitely a number of German patriots, and they've been setting the refugee facilities on fire, which is awesome, you know. So, but you gotta cut it off at the source eventually.
Yeah. What can you say about the driving force behind the immigration to, well, the migration? That's really what it is at this stage. It's like it's on the level of what we experienced during the migration age, from like, I don't know, 300. You know, CE to about 500 or 600, tremendous movements of populations for various different reasons. But it's basically one of those upheaval processes that we're in right now. But what's ultimately driving this in your view? Let's talk a bit about not only American foreign policy, but those who control American foreign policy, NATO, you know, AIPAC, some of these organizations that are sponsoring, ultimately, you know, ISIS and terrorism in Syria and in Libya. They toppled Gaddafi and all this kinds of stuff. What's your perspective on this?
Well, very recently, like when the Syrian revolution first started happening, I said, of course, they just want Bashar al-Assad out of the way. Like that was the reasoning that most people came to. But as has been revealed in recent weeks, the Finnish ambassador said that Bashar al-Assad offered to step down, like, really, really early, you know, like, Russia presented a package where Bashar al-Assad would have stepped down, and the whole, you know, the regime would have dissolved, and America said no. So, So the only way that the only other account, like the goal, right, of that whole Syrian debacle, other than removing Assad, would have to be forcing a migration into Europe, because that's the only other thing that's been accomplished. And so I think from the very highest levels of the American government, like the goal all along was to push these Syrian refugees into Europe, to make things untenable there, and then have jihadis move into Europe so that Europe could be assaulted.
What, and do you think is there a political reason behind that? Is that more of the Zionist ideology that's pushing that of perpetuating the ancient conflicts between Europe and the Jews, or what is driving that, do you think?
Oh, it's absolutely Jews. I mean, right? Like, nobody else benefits. Everybody else gets fucked. But Jews don't do very well in homogenous societies over a long term, right? Like, every place where Jews are the only minority, eventually people notice, like, what they're up to. But if it's a multi-ethnic society, right, if there's a bunch of groups competing for power, then it's and the same things happen in America, right? Which we have, like, the Federal Reserve controlling everything and really fucking the country. But when your neighborhood is flooded with Mexicans, you care about the immediate threat to, like, your daughters, right? You don't care about monetary policy or even have really a lot of time to study economics. Like, you're confronted with the immediate danger that's in front of you. And I think that's absolutely the thing that's going on here, is they want Europe to be transformed, right? They don't want it to be a European place, because it's as long as it's a European place, eventually people are going to notice the sort of economic and social manipulations that are entirely of Jewish origin, and they're going to hold the Jews to account to this problem. So a lot of people, like, you know, the cuck Gavin McKenzie always talks about, well, Jews, you know, they get hit by jihadis and violence too. And, like, yes, but it's a choice between total loss, you know, whereas the assets are rendered from the Jews completely and they are thrown out of the country, as has happened in Europe over and over again all throughout history, or they might sacrifice a couple, but they get to thrive and maintain control of civilization. And the Jews have always shown a capacity to even have their own murdered for the benefit of the Kohanim, the highest sort of the highest levels of Jews. You know, there's sort of a pecking order of who gets Jewed, right? In that the common Jews Jew everybody, but the elite Jews Jew everybody too, including the common Jews. The Kohanim and the Levites are the elite Jews, you know, and throughout Europe in history there was a pattern where they would sort of, the elite Jews would leave, you know, they'd antagonize a civilization and steal all of its wealth to a point where they could scuttle off to the next country and leave the common Jews to die in the pogroms, and then get to the new country and be like, oh, look, you know, anti-Semitism, where you let us in, you know, we've been persecuted unjustly. By the way, we have these huge sacks of gold. And so, yeah.
What I've been surprised about is that how often they can just go to a new country and, like, start a bank or start, like, lending money to the king or something like that, you know?
Yeah, it's surprising how often that works out.
Well, I mean, this, as you rightly point out, obviously then is partially, and there could be a divide here within the community of Jews. I'm not saying that, but we saw an opportunist jump on this, Netanyahu, when some of these terrorist acts happened in Europe, in Copenhagen, Paris before that. Immediately, he came out and basically says, you know, listen, all Jews come back to Israel, you know, come here, because they want to have more people there, right? And as you said, this, something similar happened here during the Second World War also, that the lush places that some enjoyed in Europe wasn't something that were ready to kind of uproot and run away from immediately. But at the same time, the Zionists wanted to drive more Jews to Israel. So it's kind of like a twofold agenda to a certain extent, as I see it, that's some will uproot, more people will ultimately go to Israel for them. And then at the same time, you can cause utter mayhem and chaos within Europe. But surely from a chess playing strategic point of view, They have to know that this is going to spawn a pretty ferocious reaction on part of Europe as well. Aren't they kind of, are they overplaying their hand a bit? I mean, they're quite bold in their strategies, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, that time will tell on that. They're hoping that we're going to be so distracted dealing with this huge influx of jihadis that we won't have time to confront and answer the Jewish question. And I think that hopefully technology will sort of liberate us there on enough time frame, and as long as we can remember as a people, because the world is becoming very small, right? It's becoming this tiny, tiny place where everybody is interconnected, and it's very, very much easier to reach into a very remote location and cause harm to somebody than it used to be, right? Like it used to be that it was a very long way away for us to influence something in Australia, but now it's like, you know, I've seen people influence Australian elections and meddle around in their media, and it's very small, unfunded people. You know, like a group of five kids from IRC can drastically change how the world works in a faraway location. So I think that past performance isn't indicative of future performance, and I think that we're going to have a real opportunity to answer this question once and for all, and not in just one place, but all places at once, because we have a global communications network now.
Yeah, organization, that's really what it takes, isn't it? Organization and somehow coalescing all this, bringing this together, and at the same time, we're also fighting, obviously, you know, people who are interested in destroying these networks that could set up any kind of opposition to this, basically, you know, the way that, you know, they might have targeted you, etc. These kinds of things would probably be more and more commonplace, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, there's going to be, because civilization is fragile. It's already really fragile, you know, and as man's become more and more enabled by technology, at the same time, there's been such a heavy-handed bit of social control applied, because they are scared that the white man's going to wake up and realize how much power has been put in his hands. You know, so there's this constant effort to make him subservient to women, to make him afraid of saying or doing anything or showing any sort of agency at all, to bog him down with an idea that is his racial privilege makes him, you know, makes him lesser than people who shit 5 feet from where they eat. As technology gets more effective, they're going to increase this level of social control proportionately.
Very interesting. You know what? I'm much more to ask you about in terms of our future, in terms of some of the hacking and some of the other things as well I want to get into with you about. But we're going to take a break here shortly, and I just wanted to kind of, plug some of your details, and I wanted you to let people know where they can follow you, both on Twitter. You have a live journal out there. Please give us the address for that, and if there's any other way people can, either get in touch with you or help you out in any way they can. So give us some of those details.
So I'm on Twitter at Rabbite, R-A-B-I-T-E. My live journal is weev.livejournal.com. I have a movie coming out on Netflix called The Hacker Wars in October.
Oh, great. That's cool. So did you produce that, do it yourself, or did you have some people helping you with that?
No, it's a documentary in which I'm one. It's also got Jeremy Hammond and Barrett Brown in it.
Right.
And I'm the best part, because they're fucking, Hammond is some fucking asshole leftist and Barrett Brown is a fucking moron. But yeah, it's a good, it's still an entertaining movie to watch without question.
All right, cool. We'll keep an eye out for that. Check out Weave, obviously, at Twitter. We'll have the links up, as you mentioned. All right, well, we'll take a short break. Stay with us, Andrew. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be right back with more.
Who controls the feminists? Who calls gamers terrorists? We do. We do. Who gets pissed when they see tits? Who says stupid shit for hits? We do. We do. Who's shoes out for their friends' careers. Who praises gone home? 'Cause quiz we do, we do. Who reviews what they've not played? Who rates every indicate? We do.
More coming up in the second hour with Andrew Arnheimer. We really go deep into Gamergate in the second hour. There's a lot of details of the story that, well, at least I didn't know about, that I didn't follow. I'm not into gaming, and I'm not an edgy young brat anymore, so we'll get some of those details. Andrew knows a whole lot more about this than I do. Plus, we get his take on the success of all the good trolls out there doing some good work, and a bunch of other topics as well. But we'll begin to talk a bit more and wrap up on the topic of Syria and Assad. RedIceMembers.com. Join us there. A three-month subscription is 15 euros. 5 euros per month. You get access to over 1,000 programs with everything from off-the-wall stuff to more down-to-earth. And in more recent years, on the more pressing political situation that we as Europeans find ourselves in, as this is a topic that trumps most others due to its severity and urgency. We need to wake up to what really is going on this front. We'll be back on Friday. We have a 314 lined up. Following that, we have Tan Staffel and Colin Flaherty. We'll talk to you after the break. Thank you so much for staying with us and for listening. RedIceMembers.com.